NASA Administrator James Bridenstine returns this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. NASA in the time of COVID-19. The leader of the United States Space Agency will share with us how it is meeting the challenge of the pandemic and looking forward toward what he still sees as a bright future across the expanse. You'll only hear this conversation on Planetary Radio. We'll look back at Apollo 13 with Planetary Society Chief Advocate Casey Dreyer. Casey will also introduce us to his Planetary Exploration Budget data set. We'll close, as always, with an examination of the night sky, courtesy of Bruce Betts. Bruce will reveal the performers of the first concert in space and much more. All of that is ahead right after this week's glance through the downlink, the Planetary Society's gift of resources that will fuel your interplanetary journey for the next 7 days. Don't miss its shot of Saturn's rings taken through the thick atmosphere of Titan by the Cassini spacecraft. Comet 2I Borisov, an interstellar visitor that was detected passing through our solar system last year, has apparently split into two pieces. Researchers made the discovery using the Hubble Space Telescope. Bruce will have more comet news during What's Up. NASA has closed the application period for its latest round of would-be astronauts. More than 12,000 people applied from every U.S. state, the District of Columbia, and 4 U.S. territories. The lucky few will be announced in roughly a year. The European-Japanese BepiColombo spacecraft flew by Earth on April 9th, using our planet's gravity to swing towards the inner solar system. To reach Mercury, the spacecraft has to perform 1 flyby of Earth, 2 flybys of Venus, and 6 flybys of Mercury itself before settling into orbit in 2025. And there are once again 6 humans aboard the International Space Station, though not for long. You'll hear about the ones coming home in my conversation with the NASA administrator. That's just a fraction of what you'll find in the downlink. It's at planetary.org/downlink, where you can also sign up to have it delivered free each week. Casey Dreyer is the Planetary Society's chief advocate and senior space policy advisor. Casey, we get to mark one major, major anniversary and then talk about this remarkable research that you've done, which we also comes up in the recent conversation we had as part of the Space Policy Edition. But let's start with Apollo 13, that wonderful failure that became a marvelous success.
A successful failure, in other words. Yes, it's the 50th anniversary of that mission happening as we're recording this. We have a bunch of new resources on planetary.org. It's right up on our homepage this week. Dived into the history of that mission, summarized some major events, obviously, in it, and went into a nice technical but readable, I think, explanation of what exactly went wrong to cause the explosion that crippled that mission. So it's worth remembering kind of the high point of what NASA was able to do in the face of adversity, and hopefully a little metaphor for how humanity is facing its current adversity right now, that we can really band together and figure out some really hard things on the fly when we need to.
Thank you for that. Highly recommended at planetary.org. Also highly recommended, talk about digging into, give us a little thumbnail description of this marvelous budget research you've done.
Well, I'm doing this project that I'm going to talk about. I did it for me, and I just assumed there were other number nerds out there who also really, really want to know how much Mariner 10 cost NASA back in the day.
Why not? Year.
Yes. So this is new. We just released this last week. I'm really proud of this work. It's the Planetary Exploration Budget data set. It is the most comprehensive accounting of NASA's expenditures on robotic planetary science missions in its entire history. That means starting in 1960, going through now 2020 and projections into 2024, of every single planetary science mission, how much NASA spent per year, how much NASA requested, how much the White House requested per year. In the 20th century, we have how much Congress mandated for various programs, where they made those mandates. So it's this incredible way you can compare not just, you know, the total amount reported spending, but the annual spending, where it went, how fast it went. And then you can really do very fine and improved adjustments for inflation that way. You can compare the differences between the White House proposals and the congressional proposals, what NASA actually spent.
It's not just, I mean, you talked about individual budgets for missions like Mariner 10, but it's the overall trends that I find especially fascinating as different destinations around the solar system sort of jockey for first place in terms of the funding that they receive from year to year.
You can find this right now at planetary.org/space advocate. If people have insight or ideas or suggestions or even just corrections into this data set, please email me. I want the community's help. I want our members' help to continually improve this data set to make it that academic reference quality source.
All right, there's your invitation to get involved from the Chief Advocate for the Planetary Society, our Senior Space Policy Advisor. He has provided more proof of that with this recent work. Thank you and congratulations, Casey. We'll talk again soon. Stay safe.
Thanks, Matt. And I can't wait to listen to the interview with NASA Administrator Bridenstine. I am just as excited about this as all of your listeners.
James Bridenstine went straight from Congress to leadership of Earth's largest space agency almost exactly 2 years ago. What a 2 years it has been. NASA was shaken up last year when the Trump administration announced that humans would return to the moon, and soon, very soon. No one suspected that barely a year later, the agency would be caught up in the greatest health challenge our planet has faced in a century. Through it all, the administrator has retained his unbridled enthusiasm for what NASA can accomplish. That characteristic enthusiasm was obvious when he joined me from his home on April 13th for this second exclusive Planetary Radio conversation. Administrator Bridenstine, thank you so much for returning to Planetary Radio. We are honored to have you back, especially at a time when I'm sure things are even busier than usual there at NASA. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It is busier than usual, for sure. It's also challenging. We are all working from home right now, at least most of us are, in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. But we do have some mission essential functions that are going forward, and I'm happy to talk about those. But I will just tell you, I am very, very proud of all of the work that this little agency is doing in these trying times, especially, you know, when kids are out of school and everybody is at home and spouses are both, in some cases, working from home at the same time. And yet we're still producing. It's quite impressive to watch this agency work.
I wanted to ask you about that specifically, but before that, I hope that you and yours were all doing well in the midst of this.
We are. I've got a wife, three kids, and a mother-in-law that all live under my roof here, and everybody is healthy. We are staying home for the most part. My wife this morning went to the grocery store to get some food, but as it is, she sits in the car and they bring the food out. So I think we're all good for now and doing everything we can to stay healthy. And I just want to encourage everybody who's listening to do the same, because if each one of us is healthy, it's good for all of us. So thank you for all the good work being done out there.
Strange times. Back to that wonderful, very innovative workforce that you've got. I mean, what are a couple of examples of how NASA is stepping up to help with the response to the pandemic?
So there's a couple of things. We have a lot of supercomputing capacity that we are making available to the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House. That supercomputing capacity will be used by the FDA and Health and Human Services and others to ultimately look for treatments and make available remedies for coronavirus as remedies become available. We have amazing biologists throughout the agency that we are making available to the federal response. And at the same time, we look at organizations like NASA JPL. They're actually working hard, no kidding, producing technology that could be used to save lives. We're talking about, you know, ventilators. So there's a lot of good work being done at the agency. We're working on how do we take the PPE, the personal protective equipment, and how do we sterilize it so we can reuse it rather than just discarding it. And that would, of course, make more PPE available to more people. We have a lot of unique technologies. We launched kind of an online brainstorming session just the other day where we asked all of our NASA employees to consider what it is that they do and how it could be helpful in the national response to coronavirus. And as you know, NASA has some amazingly brilliant employees. We've received 200 and some responses at this point. These responses have been commented on by the NASA workforce thousands of times, thousands of responses as far as comments go. And then we're going to prioritize and make them available to the different agencies, FEMA, et cetera, that are working on the response. So I think it's important to note that NASA has been and NASA will continue to be doing everything that it can to be a part of the solution to this very challenging time.
What's the status of the agency itself overall? I mean, we know a lot of centers are still at what you call stage four. Couple yes. more, I think, at stage three, including Kennedy Space Center, which is got to get a bunch of rockets up into space.
Yeah, so when you're at stage three, that means that the center is on mandatory telework other than the mission essential functions, and then those functions will continue to go forward. The two big mission essential functions that we have as an agency right now are commercial crew, so that's the effort to launch American astronauts on American rockets for the first time since the retirement of the space shuttles back in 2011. That's an essential function, really, for one reason. We have to make sure that we have access to the International Space Station, which is a $100 billion investment by the American taxpayer. Commercial crew is our assured access to this massive investment by the American taxpayer. So that mission is going forward. And then we have another mission that we're very excited about, Mars Perseverance. It used to be called Mars 2020, but we renamed it Perseverance because it is such a unique time. And we as an agency are persevering, and all of America and the world, in fact, we're all persevering. And that's why we think this is a great name for this little robot that's going to Mars. But that's mission essential for one reason, and that is that we have a very limited launch window to go to Mars. And if we miss that launch window, it will cost us upwards of $500 million over the course of 2 years, if not wreck the mission altogether, which we do not want to have happen. If you're working on one of these mission essential functions, we want you to be safer at work than you would be if you were staying at home. So that's what we're shooting for day in and day out. And it's also true, and this is very important, the NASA workforce, look, if there is anybody in the NASA workforce that doesn't feel comfortable doing what they're doing, we want them to say so, and we want them to feel free to do something else. We want to help them, in fact, do something else. We don't want anybody to do anything that makes them feel uncomfortable or unsafe. Our employees are the number one highest priority of the agency, and we want everybody to feel safe in this very unique moment in time.
It's no secret that work on some other missions and projects is either on hold or has been cut back because of the pandemic, including, sadly, the James Webb Space Telescope. But I wonder about the long-term effects, not so much of the virus itself, but about the unprecedented fiscal measures that Congress and the administration have taken to shore up the U.S. economy and jobs. Yeah. Do you worry about what this may mean for NASA in the coming years?
I worry about what it means for the nation. I'm not going to lie about that. We're talking about injecting trillions of dollars of liquidity, zero interest rates, just lots and lots of money that is basically newly created. And so I think there's a risk of inflation down the road, and that concerns me. But I will say that, I mean, I think, you know, what are the options that are in front of us? I mean, we can't let the economy go into, you know, another Great Depression. So I think people are doing the right things. It's just a terribly unfortunate circumstance. The other big challenge for NASA, and I get this question a lot, is what does this mean to the NASA budget? People have this sense that because we just passed a $2.2 trillion stimulus package, that means that NASA's budget is going to get cut. And I will say, I don't think that is the case at all. In fact, I think it's just the opposite. When the Congress makes a decision to stimulate the economy, they're doing it for a reason. But basically what happens is when the private sector quits spending, the government sector comes in and says, okay, we're going to continue to make sure that the economy is stimulated, basically to smooth out the business cycle where the economy would have normally gone down. Now it can stay smooth. That's the intent anyway, whether or not it works. It's a mixed bag when you look at past precedent. But I think the idea is sound. And I think that at this point, because the government has made a determination that they need to spend money, I think it's just the opposite. I think NASA is actually, we're going to have a good budget. And in fact, I saw, you know, the president is pushing forward on an infrastructure bill, and NASA is, we're going to play in that infrastructure bill because we are part of the American infrastructure. Each of these are signals. Number one, that the U.S. government is going to continue to spend money, and NASA is an area where that money is going to be spent. So, I mean, there is concern there from a government-wide perspective, and that does, in fact, affect NASA in the long term. But I think in the immediate term, when we think about budgets, I think NASA is as strong as it's ever been. Our budget request right now is the highest budget request in the history of the agency. We're currently at about $21 billion, and we're going up to $25.2 billion. That's a big increase. And we have bipartisan support in Congress, so I think we're in good shape. It's not about this year or next year. We're doing things that are multi-decadal and, in fact, multi-generational in nature. And we have to have the long-term vision from both parties. And right now, we need it more than ever.
Before we turn to the moon, return to the moon and Artemis, I'm thinking you remind me of how it was only about a year ago, talking about science and exploration, that you were able to assure a lot of us who care a lot about those that, don't worry, we're going to make sure that those are protected. That, of course, was before the world turned upside down. And are you still feeling confident about NASA's ability to put resources toward things that a lot of our listeners are sure looking forward to? Europa Clipper, Dragonfly, yes, down the line. And Perseverance, of course, the first phase in that long dreamt of goal of Mars sample return, which is there's a lot left to do in that direction. How do you feel now?
No, I would assure your listeners that some of those missions are not what we have deemed as mission essential. And so they're on pause right now. But I would also say that they are critically important missions that will go forward when we get past the pandemic. And I do believe we will get past the pandemic. And we want to see those missions be successful as much as everybody else does. I know there's a lot of your listeners that have been working on these missions a long time. Dragonfly, I'm telling you, I am so excited about Dragonfly.
you know, us both.
Yeah, Mars Perseverance, I'm excited about because it's going to have the world's first interplanetary helicopter.
Oh yeah,
and so that's going to be an amazing proof of concept for what Dragonfly will be at Titan. So there is so much in front of us that we're about to discover and learn. And get a better understanding of our own solar system, and in fact, all of the planets around all of the other stars, all of the exoplanets that we're learning about. You know, this morning I had a brief. We just discovered another Earth-sized planet that is orbiting the star that's pretty similar to our star, and it's orbiting that star at about the same distance the Earth is orbiting from our star. The similarities are striking, and so these things are so exciting. The Planetary Society and NASA, we've got to make sure that we're not losing sight of these kind of exploration moments that are so important.
I said we go to the moon. Let's do that. Let's go back to the moon. Artemis, very ambitious program from the start. You know, that target of 2024 can't be helped by the presence of a pandemic. And, you know, if you could start by talking about where we are with Orion, that spaceship, and that big rocket, the Space Launch System.
So Orion is now fully tested. It's ready to go. We feel really, really confident in Orion. I will say the SLS rocket right now is kind of in a holding pattern. We had an outbreak of coronavirus down in New Orleans and Stennis, which is where the SLS rocket, the first one, is being tested. And so we moved very quickly to stage 4. We talked about stage 3, which is mandatory telework plus mission essential functions can go forward. Stage 4 is basically we're shutting everything down unless it's critical infrastructure necessary for the safety of lives. That's a tough spot to be in for SLS. I will also say that I think we're still on track for 2021 for Artemis 1. Artemis 1 is going to be launched on the first SLS, which is currently at Stennis, undergoing the green run, although that has now been put on hold. Let's pretend for a second that this coronavirus goes on for a number of more months, which we're all hopeful that it does not. But if it does, and it pushes that first SLS launch into 2022, if that were to happen, we would need to be prepared to look at how that affects the second launch of SLS, or what we call Artemis 2. At this point, those two missions are operating very independently of the other. Artemis 1, if it slides, it doesn't bump up and start pushing back Artemis 2. And as long as that's the case, we could actually slip Artemis 1 if necessary. You know, you can only slip for so long, though. Eventually, it's going to impinge on Artemis 2. We're not there yet, and I think we're quite a ways from being there. But it is absolutely true that this could have an effect if this goes on too long.
Yeah. Mars, the solar system, the rest of the universe, they're not going anywhere. I guess they'll wait for us as we deal with this virus. Best of luck as you continue to lead the agency in this difficult time.
Well, thank you so much, Matt. It's always an honor.
NASA Administrator James Bridenstine and I talked on April 13th, and we talked for much longer than we have time for here. You'll find our complete conversation in this week's episode at planetary.org/radio. More of Casey and Bruce, too.
Hi, this is Kate from the Planetary Society. How does space spark your creativity? We want to hear from you. Whether you make cosmic art, take photos through a telescope, write haikus about the planets, or invent space games for your family, really any creative activity that's space-related, we invite you to share it with us. You can add your work to our collection by emailing it to us at connect@planetary.org. That's connect@planetary.org. Thanks.
Bill Nye, the Planetary Guy here. You've heard Matt deliver highlights from The Downlink, our great space news digest. You told us you want more. Well, you've got it. The Downlink now includes cool space images and fascinating facts about the cosmos that you can share with your friends and family. Best of all, you can have The Downlink delivered to your inbox each week for free. Planetary.org/connect is where to go to learn more and sign up. That's planetary.org/connect for The Downlink.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Here's the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, also author and now reader of his own works. You can find super cool space facts, which we've talked about on this show, actually gave away, on Audible at audible.com. So there. That must have been a fun experience.
It was. It was a little minor dream come true, being an Audible obsessed. An audiobook obsessed. To actually be asked to record my own audiobook was super cool.
How appropriate.
In the evening sky, of course, super bright Venus still hanging out over there in the west. And you can see on or around April 20th, you can look, it's between the bright stars of Aldebaran in Taurus and Capella in Auriga. It makes kind of a nice line. Venus is, of course, much brighter than the others, but it's fun to look for. And then in the pre-dawn east, you still have a lineup going from upper right to lower left of bright Jupiter and yellowish Saturn and reddish Mars. And they're looking quite lovely in the pre-dawn. We've mentioned, and people were excited about Comet Atlas. Well, she's breaking up. She's breaking. Glad I knew you'd get my 70s TV reference.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it may get bright in May. It's still possible, but there are at least a couple observers that have noticed it seeming to break up. And there's another comet teasing out there. So I'll keep you posted if any of these actually become bright. We move on to this week in space history. It was a big week in the early 70s, except for fashion. In 1970, Apollo 13, after a wee bit of trouble, successfully landed back on Earth. We've got a very nice page on that on our website. And then in 1971, the Soviets launched Salyut 1, the first ever space station. And in 72, Apollo 16 successfully landed on the moon. We move on to random space fact.
crazy.
So last week, we passed the anniversary of Yuri Gagarin making the first flight into space. And a lot of you probably know this space fact, but I just am sharing it for those who don't, because I find it amazing. The spacecraft Vostok 1 was not designed to land a human safely on Earth. So as per plan, Gagarin parachuted to the ground separately from his capsule after ejecting at about 7 kilometers, 23,000 feet altitude. What makes it more intriguing is the Soviets lied and made him lie to say he landed in the capsule, and they didn't admit that he parachuted until 1971. And a little tidbit, by the way, the FAI, the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, who handles spaceflight records, the rules of the time required landing in the spacecraft to be considered the first spaceflight. But they later gave him a special award.
Nicely done with the French, by the way.
And, and sorry, just if I don't know.
Okay, the contest.
What mission played the first musical instruments in space? How do we do, Matt?
Here is the answer from our poet laureate. He's back, Dave Fairchild in Kansas. It was almost Christmas in December 65, probably a year or two before Bruce was alive, when Gemini, that six, took flight with Stafford and Shira, who played the tune of Jingle Bells, a blues harp space hurrah. You have to work a little bit to get it to rhyme with Wally's name. They had bells, I'm told, up there as well, right?
They did indeed. They had a harmonica and bells brought aboard by Wally Schirra and along with Tom Stafford aboard Gemini 6A.
Here's another winner I'm delighted to see. It has been over 4.5 years since he last won. Our faithful listener, Mark Little, in Northern Ireland, he actually visited our headquarters not terribly long ago with his family. He was on vacation in California. He says Jingle Bells was played by an 8-note Hohner Little Lady harmonica, now on display with a dental floss and Velcro tether at the Smithsonian. Isn't that great?
Yes.
Hey, Mark, congrats. You are, if you want it, you get Bruce and me on any kind of brief recording, voice recording that you want to greet your telephone callers on your smartphone or whatever. We don't care.
All right. You just talked to someone. Let's have a question about him. In what kind of aircraft did NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine fly combat missions off the carrier USS Abraham Lincoln? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
So cool. You have until the 22nd. That'll be April 22nd, Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer. It won't be hard to find, will it? And if you're chosen by random.org, Bruce and me will record for you. If you like, we won't force it on you, we promise.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about your favorite fruity-flavored cereal. Thank you, and good night.
That's Bruce Betts. He's our $6 million man, marked up for inflation. We can rebuild him, you know. He joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members whose voices are heard at NASA and across the world. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Be safe, everyone. Ad Astra.